Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. The World Health Organization issued an appeal on Monday for all countries to do more to protect people from the dangers of tobacco and secondhand smoke. In the last 15 years since WHO's Empower tobacco control measures were introduced globally, smoking rates have fallen. An impressive 70% of the world's population are now shielded by at least one protective measure, including taxes on tobacco products, advertising bans, or smoke-free spaces. The UN Health Agency's latest report indicates that 74 countries protect their population with smoke-free laws in public indoor areas. But more protective measures are needed across the board, WHO said, particularly to protect against secondhand smoke and denormalize smoking. Here's WHO's Director for Health Promotion, Dr. Rüdiger Krecht, speaking in Geneva.
Let's not forget that tobacco use continues to be one of the biggest public health threats, with 8.7 million people dying from tobacco-related diseases every year. 1.3 million of these deaths are amongst non-smokers that are subjected to secondhand smoke.
Despite progress against tobacco dangers in recent years, 44 countries have yet to adopt any of the WHO's recommendations on tobacco control, and more need to strengthen compliance, the UN Health Agency said. WHO experts continue to urge countries to take action against what they've called a tobacco epidemic and push back against the tobacco and nicotine industries. The UN Special Representative for Niger has strongly condemned the seizure of power by force following an attempted coup and the detention of Niger's president on Wednesday. Speaking at an emergency summit on Sunday, the head of the United Nations Office for West Africa and the Sahel, Leonardo Santos Simao, said that democratic governance, peace and stability in Niger were at risk. Mr. Simao further warned that this will exacerbate an already deteriorating security situation in the Sahel region before assuring the economic community of West African states that the UN will continue to provide aid to vulnerable populations. On Thursday, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres demanded the immediate and unconditional release of President Mohamed Bazoum after a group of soldiers announced the president's removal on Wednesday evening. According to reports, West African nations intend to impose sanctions and threatened force unless President Bazoum is reinstated within 7 days. The world won't end if it warms by more than 1.5 degrees. That's the message from Jim Skier, the newly appointed head of the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC. Speaking to reporters, the UN climate expert warned against putting too much value on the target of limiting global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius, even though UN estimates suggest that countries' current commitments are likely to fall short of this goal. He said that people should not despair if global temperatures were to increase by this amount and encouraged optimism as new measures taken are weakening the impacts of climate change. The UN expert, who has been involved with the IPCC since its foundation in the 1990s, said that over-communicating this Armageddon message will paralyze people and prevent them from looking to solutions. Mr. Skier insisted that the short-term focus should be on expanding renewable electricity to reduce emissions, while in the longer term, technological solutions such as underground carbon capture would become necessary. Caitlin Kelly, UN News.
Coming to you live from Northeast Jefferson County.
Good afternoon, listeners. Lunchtime listeners at the listening post here in Radio Free Kansas. I'm your host, Mike Cadell. The weather here today is very interesting. It has been for the last couple days as the, the heat dome has melted away. Now it is cool. Temperatures yesterday was like 84. The wind today is coming out of generally the south-southeast. And it fluctuates between 2.5 to 5 miles per hour. So, and the current temperature is right around 84, and it is anticipated to break 90 degrees today. So we're back into the warming trend. This is nothing unusual. This is August weather to me. So I'm not quite as alarmist as others, but I do feel that it's worth listening tomorrow, weather on Wednesday here at RFK to Alex Smith at Radio EcoShock and Maria Gillardin at TUC Radio. That'll be tomorrow. And as a reminder, yes, the second hour, I've had it on close contact that John Grant will be live beginning in the second hour. Today we have to do in the first hour Counterspin and the latest headlines from Democracy Now. So I think, plus, by the way, plus, this is going to be interesting, listeners. There's a short musical interlude, and the master at the show, at the switchboard, Tristan, will be selecting the crime jazz until John Grant comes on. So it's a great day. I hope you're having a good day. And always remember to support those who support Radio Free Kansas. Thank you for listening. Over to you, Tristan.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Pakistan, at least 54 people were killed, 200 injured Sunday as explosions rocked a political rally in the northwestern Bajor district, which borders Afghanistan. The deadly blast was triggered by a suicide bomber during a gathering of the conservative Jamiat Ulema Ismail Faisal party, which is part of Prime Minister Shahbaz Sharif's ruling coalition. The bombing came amidst mounting insecurity ahead of elections planned for November. No one's yet claimed responsibility for the attack, though police said the Islamic State group could be to blame. A number of children died in the attack. Russia says it shot down three Ukrainian drones over Moscow Sunday, two of which damaged a high-rise building that may house government offices. It's the latest in a series of similar attacks the Kremlin has blamed on Kyiv. This is Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky.
Gradually, the war is returning to the territory of Russia, to its symbolic centers and military bases, and this is an inevitable, natural, and absolutely fair process.
On Saturday, Russian strikes killed at least two people in the northeastern Ukrainian city of Sumy and two people in Zaporizhia. Meanwhile, Deputy Security Council Chair and former Russian President Dmitry Medvedev said there would be no other option but to launch a nuclear attack if Ukraine is successful in its NATO-backed counteroffensive. Elsewhere, Poland sounded the alarm over Wagner forces in Belarus, which it says are moving closer to the Polish border. Following the Russia-Africa summit last week in St. Petersburg, Russian President Vladimir Putin said a peace initiative presented by African leaders could be the basis for ending the war if Ukraine ceased its attacks. Meanwhile, the African Union said Putin's offer to supply some African countries with grain was not sufficient to guarantee a stable food supply.
President Putin said he was ready to help us with grain supplies. It is important, but maybe not enough. We need to achieve a ceasefire because it is always something unpredictable. And the longer it is, the more unpredictable it becomes.
In Chad, tens of thousands of refugees who fled violence in Sudan face another lethal threat, shortages of running water amid scorching temperatures. Sudanese refugees say the little water they have access to is needed for drinking, leaving little for toilets and sanitation.
We wait for water for 6 hours and we spend the whole day here, overcrowded. There are water cuts, heat, hunger, thirst, and the water containers are limited. We have no pots, mattresses, blankets, or covers. We spend the day in the heat. Whether you come to get water, it's hot, or you sit in the tent, it's also hot.
As heat waves envelop the globe, here in the United States, the Conference of Mayors and the National League of Cities are calling on Congress to pass the Extreme Heat Emergency Act. The bill would add extreme heat and wildfire smoke events to a list of disasters that can unlock supplemental assistance from FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency. On Thursday, a youth activist confronted White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre over President Biden's approval of new coal, oil, and gas projects. This is Elise Joshi, Executive Director of Gen Z for Change.
Will the administration stop approving new oil and gas projects and align with youth, science, and frontline communities from the North Slope of Alaska to Louisiana?
White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre then proceeded in the defense of the Biden administration before being interrupted again by Joshi.
You have approved multiple projects since then and more at a faster rate than the Trump administration. We need you to act on your campaign promises.
Declare a climate emergency.
In British Columbia, a third firefighter has died battling Canada's worst wildfire season on record, which has scorched some 30 million acres, an area larger than the nation of Cuba. Millions of Canadians and more than 120 million people across the United States have faced air quality alerts this summer due to smoke from the fires. In Turkey, security forces have unleashed water cannons and tear gas on villagers and activists protecting the Akbelen forest in the province of Muğla from being cleared for coal mining. At least 14 people were arrested last week. Local communities, environmental groups have brought legal challenges and put their own bodies on the line in an attempt to stop YK Energy's expansion of open pit mining in Akbelen. An activist with the group Beyond Fossil Fuels said, quote, as tens of thousands of people across the Mediterranean region flee rampaging wildfires caused by the climate crisis, it's incomprehensible that a company is allowed to destroy a forest, one of our most important carbon sinks, to expand a coal mine, they said. The head of Niger's presidential guard has declared himself the leader of a transitional government following Wednesday's coup d'etat, which deposed the West African nation's democratically elected president, Mohamed Bazoum. On Friday, General Abdurrahman Tchiani said on state-run television, the coup was necessary to prevent the gradual and inevitable demise of Niger. Over the weekend, ECOWAS, a bloc of 15 West African nations, slapped sanctions on leaders of the coup and threatened to expel them by force unless they cede power within a week. On Sunday, thousands of supporters of the junta attempted to storm the French embassy in the capital, Niamey, burning French flags and chanting slogans against Niger's former colonial ruler. They were turned away by soldiers firing tear gas. Many Nigerians are rejecting the interference of foreign actors following the coup.
The international community that says it's here for us, we don't want it. We don't want its moral lesson because it's no longer credible in the eyes of Africans. We can't understand why they support a coup d'etat in Chad and oppose them in Mali and Burkina Faso. It's an internal problem which only concerns Nigerians. If we call on them, they can cooperate with us, but we don't want their moral lessons.
In Kenya, the government of President William Ruto and the opposition coalition agreed to establish a joint committee to, quote, resolve their differences following deadly protests earlier this month. Opposition leader Raila Odinga called the protests over the high cost of living and tax hikes on Friday. An appeals court lifted a freeze on the contested tax law, which doubles fuel taxes and introduces a new housing levy. Some activists have questioned the court's move.
We are fearing that there is an executive interference in that ruling, because prior to this, we saw the executive come out boldly condemning the courts, declaring the courts that the courts are against the government. The courts are being used by external forces.
In Lebanon, at least five people were killed Sunday during clashes between rival groups in one of the largest Palestinian refugee camps near the city of Sidon. The fighting broke out after an unknown gunman tried to assassinate an Islamist militant leader, killing a companion instead. In response, militants killed a military general and three other members of the Fatah group, which is part of the Palestinian Authority. At least seven people were also wounded in the violence, including at least two children. Palestinian factions in the camp have for years cracked down on militant Islamist groups. The overcrowded Ain el-Hilwa camp houses some 55,000 Palestinians. In related news, the head of the Palestinian Authority, Mahmoud Abbas, and the leader of Hamas have formed a reconciliation committee aimed at uniting rival Palestinian political movements. Abbas and Ismail Haniyeh met for rare in-person talks in Egypt Sunday, along with the heads of other Palestinian groups. Hamas, which runs a parallel government in the besieged Gaza Strip, has called on the Palestinian Authority to end its security collaboration with Israel and cease the detention of political prisoners. The group has also called for the formation of an inclusive Palestinian parliament through democratic elections. Friction between Hamas and Fatah, the dominant party in the Palestinian Authority, has persisted persisted since 2007 after violence erupted between the two groups over control of Palestinian territories. In the United States, the Justice Department has launched a civil rights investigation into the Memphis police. This is Kristen Clark, Assistant Attorney General at the DOJ.
We received multiple reports of officers escalating encounters with community members resulting in excessive force. There are also indications that officers may use force punitively when faced with behavior they perceive to be insolent. The information we reviewed also shows that officers may use force against people who are already restrained or in custody.
The targeting and abuse of black residents by Memphis police came under a national spotlight following the January killing of Tyree Nichols, a 29-year-old black man who was pepper sprayed and fatally beaten by police during a traffic stop. And a federal judge has blocked an Arkansas law that would allow criminal charges against librarians and booksellers for providing, quote unquote, harmful materials to children and teens. The law, signed by Republican governor, former Trump spokesperson Sarah Huckabee Sanders in March, would have gone into effect tomorrow, Tuesday. The ACLU filed the lawsuit on behalf of various Arkansas libraries, bookstores, librarians, and readers. 17-year-old plaintiff, high school student Hayden Kirby, said, quote, "I want to fight for our rights to intellectual freedom and ensure that libraries remain spaces where young Arkansans can explore diverse perspectives," she said. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, if corporate news media didn't matter, we wouldn't talk about them. But elite, moneyed outlets do, of course, direct public attention to some issues and not to others, and suggest the possibility of some social responses, but not others. It's that context that the African American Policy Forum hopes folks will bring to their new book, based on years of research, called Say Her Name, Black Women's Stories of Police Violence and Public Silence. It's not, of course, about excluding black men and boys from public conversation about police violence, but about the value of adding black women to our understanding of that phenomenon as a way to help make our response more meaningful and impactful. If along the way we highlight that ignoring the specific intersectional meaning that policies and practices have for women who are also black, well, that would improve journalism too. We'll talk about Say Her Name with one of the key workers on that ongoing project, Kevin Manofu, Senior Research and Writing Fellow at African American Policy Forum. That's coming up this week on Counterspin, but first, a quick look back at some recent press. After its embarrassing town hall with Donald Trump, which helped precipitate the downfall of Chair and CEO Chris Licht, CNN has doubled down on the format, at least for Republican candidates. As Julie Holler writes for Fair.org, since Trump's May 10th appearance, the network has featured GOP candidates Nikki Haley, Mike Pence, and Chris Christie, and more are promised. Curiously, however, no offers to Democratic or third-party candidates have been announced, inviting the question, what purpose do these town halls serve? Everyone knows the non-journalistic, chaotic evil that ensued from CNN's May 10th Trump rally, starting but not ending with the floor manager's instructions to the audience that while applause was permitted, booing was not. The network's ratings plunged after the fact, and CEO Licht was dropped like a suddenly hot rock. CNN anchor Anderson Cooper shook a finger at the many, many, many people mad about a nominally news outlet hosting what was essentially a Trump rally. He went on air to scold, quote, "Many of you felt CNN shouldn't have given Trump any platform to speak. Do you think staying in your silo and only listening to people you agree with is going to make that person go away?" Close quote. But Julie Holler asks, what democratic norms require offering a serial liar a town hall stuffed full of supporters in which the audience is instructed that applause is welcomed but booing is forbidden? In what way exactly does that serve the public interest? In reality land, where one hopes reporters would live, you would be hard-pressed to find a living soul who doesn't know exactly who Trump is and who his supporters are and how they can be expected to behave. That the town hall was devoid of thoughtful policy discussions, but chock-a-block with insults and falsehoods, surprised no one. Well, some of Trump's Republican challengers have broken with him to some extent, though few are risking alienating his followers by forcefully denouncing his lies. Still, CNN's own fact checks of his subsequent GOP town halls showed that Haley, Pence, and Christie were also permitted numerous falsehoods without real-time challenge by their journalist hosts. Haley, for instance, claimed that crime is at all-time highs. That's false. That Roe versus Wade made abortion anytime, anywhere, for any reason, the law of the land. That's not even close to true, according to CNN's own fact checks, and that the U.S. is very good when it comes to emissions, while the Chinese and Indians are the problem. That's seriously misleading, as the U.S. is second to China in total current emissions, with India well in third place, and the U.S. has much higher total historical emissions, much higher per capita emissions than China or India. But Jake Tapper, the host, didn't push back against any of those claims. Or look at Mike Pence's town hall, in which he announced that inflation is at a 40-year high. Well, no, that's not true. The inflation rate has actually fallen for 10 straight months. He said the Trump-Pence family separations at the border began under Obama, and Trump and Pence simply continued them. That's also false. And that the Trump administration reduced CO2 emissions beyond what the previous administration had committed to just through American innovation, through expanding American energy and natural gas. Well, CNN didn't actually fact check that one, but it's obviously and overtly false. But host Dana Bash didn't challenge any of those statements either. Lest you think it's kind of all-purpose laziness, Julie Holler points out that CNN has announced no plans to give any Democratic or independent candidates town halls. In that case, they somehow find some principles. For instance, CNN's Jake Tapper has declared that on principle he'd never be part of a town hall with Robert Kennedy because Kennedy spreads dangerous misinformation, which absolutely he certainly does. But if the concept doesn't apply to Donald Trump, how is that a principle and not just a preference? The public does need to understand the candidates they'll be choosing from next year, which means news outlets have to offer them a platform. But the kind of platform offered is crucial. In the Trump era, town halls just don't offer the tools necessary to hold politicians accountable, whether those politicians are Trump or Kennedy or DeSantis or Biden. Good journalism demands direct encounters with politicians, with incisive, probing questions that speak to people's actual needs and concerns, and real-time fact-checking. Or if it's TV, maybe a taped format with fact-checking provided prior to airing. If presidential candidates or political candidates of any stripe can't agree to a platform that can hold them accountable, well, then maybe they don't deserve to have a media platform at all. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. Like most powerful exercises, it's a simple one. Professor and legal scholar Kimberly Crenshaw asks audience members to stand as she lists names of black people killed by law enforcement in this country, and to sit when they hear a name that they don't recognize. For Eric Garner, George Floyd, Michael Brown, most of the crowd, whatever crowd it is, students, academics, the general public, stay standing. But when it gets to Sandra Bland, Atiana Jefferson, it thins and thins. And by the time it gets to Rakia Boyd and Michelle Cousseau, generally everyone is seated. Is that because black women's deaths via the same state-sanctioned violence that kills black boys and men are less compelling? Are the victims less worthy? Or do they somehow not matter? It's hard to tease out and to talk about what's happening. But if we genuinely want to address racist police violence and bring all of us into the imagined future, we have to have the conversation. The Say Her Name Project from the African American Policy Forum, on whose board I serve, has worked to lift up the names of women, trans women, and girls killed by law enforcement on and off duty, and to talk about how their murders are the same as and different from police murders of black men and boys. That project is now reflected in a book, Say Her Name, Black Women's Stories of Police Violence and Public Silence, out this week from Haymarket Books. Joining us now is Kevin Manofu, senior researcher and writing fellow at the African American Policy Forum. He joins us now by phone. Welcome to Counterspin, Kevin Manofu.
Hi, Janine. It's a pleasure to be on. I'm very, very grateful for you making the time. And great to be on the show.
Absolutely. Well, as you and I both know, the Say Her Name Project encompasses activism, art, research, and writing, and support for families, you know. But the heart of it, the radiating center, is still this really simple thing. Say her name. Why is that so meaningful?
I think in describing that, it's kind of useful to go back to the origins of the movement, because people are always interested in how it developed. People have probably heard about it, but oftentimes maybe confused about its history. And so Say Her Name developed in around December 2014 during the protests that were ignited in New York City after the acquittal of the police officer who had killed Eric Garner. At the march, where thousands of protesters from across the country of all ages and all races joined together and were standing up against police violence against black people and mentioning the names of men who had been killed by police violence. In the context of that protest, the African American Policy Forum went at the protest trying to uplift the names of women who had been killed by police violence. And so in the process of being in part of that activity, we were saying the names of these women, saying their names out loud, and looking at the looks of the lack of recognition, of confusion from the other participants at this protest. And I think that was emblematic of the erasure of these stories and the ways in which, by saying the names of these women, we were speaking to them into existence in people's minds, into people's memories, and making them understand a problem that up until then they hadn't been able to see.
There's a thing that we talk about, the loss of the loss, which is, you know, there's a horror that happens, obviously, when somebody is killed by police and where you understand that it's emblematic of the worthlessness of black lives in terms of law enforcement in this country. But when it's a black woman or a trans woman or a girl and then it doesn't get acknowledged, there's like a deeper level of loss there, right? And that's kind of what this project is about.
Exactly. So as the voice described it, you know, there's the immense loss of what it means for a person to lose a daughter, a mother, a sister, friends in their families. These are women who all had incredibly full lives. Lots of them had children, were all loved by family members and the communities. So there's that loss that everyone who's been through, who grieves or has lost someone unexpectedly will suffer. And I think that loss is exacerbated by the fact that these are women who were killed by the same institutions that are designed to protect them. So the police officers that we entrust with the safety of our communities and in our neighborhoods and in our cities are the people who are responsible for taking away these lives. And then once we understand that loss, there's the secondary loss that the family members are burdened with, which is the loss of their loss. So their loss is not legible to people. People don't recognize that this is something which is a tragedy. People don't recognize that that's something which is a problem. People don't recognize the injustice of being killed. If you are, in the case of one of the women, Miriam Carey, who was killed while driving with her 18-month-old child by the Secret Service in front of the White House. If you're killed like India Kega, who was also driving with her son in Virginia Beach and killed in a hail of bullets. If you're killed in the context of your own home over what was outstanding traffic violation like Corinne Gaines. So an inability for the general public to see the horror of these deaths and the loss that those deaths have on the family members that survive is what we like to term the loss of the loss, and why this book is such a big intervention to try and publicize and get that loss into the public's attention.
And to inform the conversation about state-sanctioned police violence against black people. But I want to say, let me just intercede early. I want us to dispense early with the idea that, say, her name is somehow an invidious project. And I think some listeners might be surprised to hear, but we know that this project has been met with the idea that if you are uplifting the names of black women and girls who have been killed by police, that somehow that means you don't think it matters that black men and boys have been killed by police, you know. But I will say, having done a lot of looking into media coverage of the issue, very early on, we absolutely saw the question of state-sanctioned police violence as a question about police killing black men and boys. And to the extent that women were in the conversation, they were mothers and wives and sisters of black men who were the victims of state violence. And so let's just address the fact that this is not about saying that black men and boys are not also.
I think that's a very vital thing to add, and thanks for making that, Janine, because the whole impetus of this campaign is understanding that our politics we need to expand the scope of our politics, not just replace the names that we include. So we're not just replacing black women and black men in the conversation, but understanding that we need to have a gender-inclusive understanding of police violence. So, of course, we know that cross-racial groups, that men are killed more often. Black men are killed more than any other race and gender group. But we do know that the disproportionate, that is the black women only represent about 10% of the female population in the United States, yet account for 1/5 of all women killed by the police. More so, research suggests that 3 out of 5 black women who are killed by police are unarmed. So there's a particular vulnerability to being a black woman that exacerbates the chance of being in a deadly and a lethal police encounter that other women don't face, and even a lot of men don't face as well. So being able to speak about that is able to make us understand how we should be able to hold the death of George Floyd in conversation with the death of Breonna Taylor, which happened only a couple of months before George Floyd was killed. So that is the point and the impetus of our project.
Well, and also a problem that is not named, is not studied, is not addressed, and then it's easier for people to say it's not really a problem because we don't have any data on it. So part of this is just to actually just collect some numbers and to say this is happening.
Absolutely. The kind of driving mantra of our work and our broader work of the Policy Forum is that we can't fix the problem that we can't see, that we can't name. And so being able to speak about, maybe to give a bit of background, this book is building on work that we did in 2015, which was the inception of our Say Her Name report. The Say Her Name report there looked at the ways in which Black women were killed. So, for example, driving while Black is something that we have a context for and understanding for from looking at the history of how people commonly understand police violence. But looking at, for example, how often Black women who are in a mental health crisis are killed, that expanded the scope of how we understood police violence, because not a lot of people would understand that Black women are often killed by the police when they actually ask for help. So giving ourselves these frames for understanding the ways in which this problem occurs both gave us a comparative to link it back to the ways in which we commonly understand it and also expanded the scope for how we wanted to respond to the crisis.
We absolutely. There is a narrative which maybe some listeners are not privy to or don't understand, but there is a dominant narrative in which Black men who are killed by police are victims of state violence, but Black women who are killed, what did they do to get themselves killed? And so introducing both the mental health vector, but just there's meaning in saying that it's both the same. It's, you know, racist police violence is similar, and then there are also distinctions. And if we don't pay attention to them, then we can't address them.
I think part of that work has been there's a policy intervention that is required, of course. There's legislation both across the country and in certain states that needs to be affected to change this. But a big part of this is also just a narrative shift. So it's how the media reports on the ways in which Black women are killed or reports on defiant report on them at all. And I think the Breonna Taylor example is indicative of that. The fact that Breonna Taylor was killed in March and very little was made of the fact at the time on a national scale. And then a few months later, that's when her name joined that conversation. You know, the fact that Tanisha Anderson was killed only a few days before Tamir Rice was killed by the same police department. The ways in which the media can actually just do their job better to make sure that we have a more capacious and broader frame of police violence and are able to tell the stories of these women in a way that doesn't show deference to the narrative that emanate from the police sources and, you know, show the full beauty of their lives.
So important. To come back to the book specifically, this book is not, it's not just a book. It's meant to be a tool. You know, it's not meant to just kind of sit on a shelf. And Fran Garrett, who is the mother of Michelle Cousseau, who was killed by law enforcement, she talks in the book about how things are actually different based on the work around Say Her Name and how the mental health response in her community, which happens to be Phoenix, Arizona, but now mental health wellness orders are handled differently, and it's not necessarily law enforcement that comes first to your door. So the book is a way of also encouraging action. It's not just documentation of sad things. It's about how to make things different.
Absolutely. At the heart of the book, and I would encourage all your listeners to go out and get it at a bookstore near you and online, at the heart of the book is the Say Her Name Mothers Network. The Say Her Name Mothers Network is formed not long after the inception of the Say Her Name movement, and it represents mothers, daughters, sisters, family members who have lost women to police violence. And that community has existed and has existed as a source of advocacy, a source of community. It's connected them to women across the country from Virginia to California, from New York to Texas. It shows that there is a community out there, and through this community, and then particularly through storytelling, artivism, using art to disrupt popular narratives. We released a song with Janelle Monae, who also wrote the foreword for the book, called Say Her Name, Hear You Talk About. And that's designed to just, you know, all of these narrative interventions are the seed for what becomes policy and actually becomes change. You know, this is a historical project that Black people have been doing in this country since our arrival, and the great Black feminist legacy that brings this book into fruition.
And then just on media, I think some listeners might think, well, media are covering police violence against Black women, and what they might be thinking about is these terrible wrenching videos, you know, or these just horrible images of Black women being abused by law enforcement. And, you know, we want to be careful about this because I think for a lot of people that might look like witnessing, you know, that might look like seeing what's happening. But that can't be the end of the story. And certainly for journalists, the responsibility of reporters, but also for all of us, is to not just look at it, but to do something about it. And I wonder if you were talking to reporters or thinking about journalism generally, what would be just kind of your thoughts about what would be actually righteous response to what's happening?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that, of course, we live in an age of spectacle, and there is still a great spectacle to Black suffering. And the visibility of that has increased with the internet and social media, has been important in being able to document abuses and violence across the country. But the story can't end there. It can't end there at just that particular moment. You know, if this was a camera shot, the camera needs to be expanded to look at the dynamics of the communities, the relationship between police forces and these communities, and the patriarchal relationship between the male police officers and women, the racialized relationship between a police force which has been designed to serve white interests and Black communities. And so to do the vital work of understanding what led to that situation, what led to the, you know, the Black girl being violently dragged out of a classroom or beaten for swimming or killed in a part of the misguided war on drugs, you know, to understand that broader story is kind of the vital work of journalism that we need at the moment and the vital work that is actually going to save lives.
Well, do you have any final thoughts, Kevin Manofu, about this importance and the place of this intervention in the public media conversation about, say, her name and about police violence against Black women? Any final thoughts?
I think the Hinnane book, as I said, it features different interviews with members of Say Her Name Network. And so just hearing those stories and actually getting behind a new story and learning about the lives that should have been is really important for everyone to be able to contextualize and humanize the women that that form part of the network and this broader movement, and look at the ways in which the knowledge that is being lifted up here is vital to us understanding racism, sexism. And at the same time, while being cognizant of the fact that, like, that is the precise knowledge which at the moment, with a backlash to what is termed wokeness across the country, is attempting to erase, I can imagine that the content of the Say Her Name book would inflame the sensitivities of various conservatives and right-wing people that are attempting to silence our ability to speak about our circumstances because they don't want us to change it. So in this context of that environment, reading this book, sharing it with your communities, letting people know about the problem, letting people know that to truly respond to structural racism, to racial injustice, we have to have a gender expansive, gender inclusive understanding of it. I think that's the work, that's the kind of mission of Say Her Name, and we've been very grateful to be supported by the public so far. We've seen the movement grow, but, you know, there's still so much work to be done, and that's the work that we're excited to continue.
We've been speaking with Kevin Manofu, Senior Research and Writing Fellow at the African American Policy Forum. You can learn more about this work on the website aapf.org. Thank you so much, Kevin Manofu, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks, Janine.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR, based in New York. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
Good afternoon, listeners. Boy, I'm telling you, that is 1975. That is actually the name of the of the hit. John Grant's with us right now, and it's done by a guy named Dan McLeod, who does a lot of crime jazz on YouTube, and he is very considerate and lets it all be royalty free, so I can play it.
Oh, right, it's really wonderful music. I love the intro. Yeah.
Yeah, it's not, it's not the end.
A little like, Henry Mancini and Peter Gunn, you know, all that stuff.
What's amazing is McLeod does all this stuff electronically. He gives it away. Mm-hmm. And amazing guy.
He's a people's artist, man, a people's artist.
Hey, listen, have you figured out we've got John Grant on the radio, Radio Free Kansas, today on Tuesday? This can't be happening Tuesday with John Grant. So, I mean, and we've got the master of the switchboard, Tristan. He's running the show now. He's really
the man at the control.
He's the man behind the curtain. That's what he is. I mean, he's, could be a good or bad thing if he doesn't like it. Listeners, if he doesn't like us, we're off air. Well, what's the weather here? The weather here is we're back up in the 90s, but we had like 3 days of 80 degrees. Tomatoes are going like crazy here. Finally, we finally caught up with Pennsylvania. I mean, you reported that your tomatoes were going crazy. People were lots of stuff.
God, I just made spaghetti sauce out of 15 of them. You know, they're just coming so much that skin them and make my own spaghetti sauce. You know, it's really delicious.
Yeah, you have to.
And we got squash. We got eggplants. I got this big Blue Hubbard squash. I don't know what the hell it is, but it's
heard of
about
it.
The size of a basketball. It's blue and it's beautiful.
What?
And Blue Hubbard squash.
You can't eat it.
I'm going to look it up and find out how to cook it. You bake it, I guess. You know.
Oh, it's a birdhouse. That's all. It's a gourd. It's now becoming a gourd.
A Blue Hubbard?
Yeah, they all turn to gourds. Don't you know all squash turns to gourds and then...
Well, yeah, but I'm going to eat the goddamn thing first.
Well, you must be a fan of Greta Thunberg. I mean, are these people out here in Lawrence, Kansas?
What does that have to do with Greta Thunberg eating squash?
Well, she probably eats everything she grows.
We're having meals that are like 80%, you know, count the onions and things I put in things, but it's like 80% homegrown, you know, at the height of the summer. We're just eating right out of the garden. And plus, we got this goddamn peach tree that is just going great guns. It's putting out peaches. I've made, you know, two big peach cobblers already where they're coming at us with all these peaches. It's incredible.
Well, you're
delicious.
All right. Yeah. You're going to have to learn to can. That's a can.
Right,
can.
Well, I like to, I can freeze them. Yeah, same thing, but freeze them for a while, you know.
You're not a prepper. John Grant is not a prepper. He's not ready for
No, I'm probably not a prepper. I just do my best. Sure. You know, I'm not a great gardener. I just put it in, and God, I hope it comes up. And then when it does, I'm amazed, you know.
It is amazing, isn't it? It is amazing.
Just,
it really is.
Life wants to live. You see these things poking out in my little nursery, and then I put them in the garden, and some work, and I put the ones that work in and the ones that are strong. And by now, my God, they're just putting out fruit like you wouldn't believe, vegetables. It's a great process. I love it.
Well, it's a great season right now. I mean, we're very lucky.
Yeah.
I mean, all the rain. I mean, it's like a monsoon out here in Kansas. We get...
Really?
Desert
wow.
heat, yeah, desert heat, and then we get, you know, torrential
cool
rain.
Down.
We
last several days have been really just lovely here, you know, I guess in the 80s. It's just very comfortable. Yeah.
Well, I guess we'll just have to be thankful we're not Ukraine. I emailed prominent peace activists on my email list, and if you want to be on it, it's very easy, listeners. It's Blue Barn News Central. It's long, but no, it's one word, bluebarnnewscentral@gmail.com. And I was emailing them comparing Kansas to Ukraine.
Ooh.
And I got a few kickbacks saying, well, not really. You know, Kansas is not on the border contiguous, you know, because the Republicans are talking about invading Mexico and sending troops. And everybody thought,
well, the Republicans talk about a lot of crap. You know, come on. They're going to invade Mexico.
They're the majority in the House. In the House of Representatives.
Well, they're majority in the House for now. I don't know why I have some ridiculous faith in the American system. I don't know why. I'm such a critic of it in many ways. But, you know, like in Watergate and all that, I always think, you know, it's going to right itself. Now, granted, it's corrupt as it comes. You know, I mean, the United States of America is, you know, a swamp of corruption. Of course, Donald Trump got that right. He didn't tell us that he was the chief crook, but he's better at it.
He wants to.
He and his family are much better at it than Joe Biden. My God, you know.
I mean, I think they're naked.
They're trying to get on poor Hunter Biden. You know, he's. You know, they show naked pictures of him when he's on crack cocaine and things like that. Like, you know, leave the poor man alone. You know, he's obviously not. You know, presidential relatives. Or, you know, remember Jimmy Carter's brother who was
selling Billy Beer
and all this, and he was cutting a deal with the Iranians or something without telling his brother. You know, it's like he was doing all this stupid stuff. And, you know, of course, Carter was not reelected.
Right. Well, I mean, Bill Clinton had Monica, and you know, I can go. I'm thoroughly trained in the foibles of the Democratic Party in the last 20, 30 years. But you know, I tend to sit back and I think, yeah, but the foibles of the Republican Party are the military.
Yeah, there are foibles.
Foibles, and their foibles are drenched in blood all over the world, and I'm
They're just dishonest to the core these days. I just think of this champ, you know, the wrestling champ in his shirt sleeves. What's his name? Jordan, Representative Jordan. The weaponization of government, and you know and it's like, what are they talking about? You know, because. Obviously, if Trump were elected, he would weaponize everything he could, you know. And so now Biden is weaponizing the Attorney General's office and, you know, persecuting poor Donald Trump by encouraging, felony charges and, you know, on state and federal level. And, apparently, Fannie Williams in Atlanta said she's ready to go. We're going to have a state charges in Atlanta before September 1st, she said. So, and those charges, he cannot be elected and he cannot pardon himself. So, you know, he can't pardon himself from a jail sentence in Georgia, state jail sentence in Georgia.
That'd be sort of poetic. That'd be poetic.
Yeah. He's just, you know, he can't do it. My prediction, you know, if predictions amount to anything, is that we're going to have some pretty creative judge work. The judges are going to have to put their creative heads together, you know, with what, four felony charges and a state charge, fifth charge or something like that. You know, they're going to have to get into sentencing. How do we sentence this fellow? He's unique. And two, you know, do we do it concurrently or what is the other one? consecutively, you know?
Consecutively.
And the point is, I think, in my view, is it's going to be the Howard Hughes solution. they're going to find a nice penthouse somewhere, and they'll take the two top floors, maybe three floors, but the top floor would be a lockdown for the ex-president, and he could have Mr. Nauta could be Walt Nauta could be his valet serving his sentence at the same time. And, they would decide whether he could have access to the Internet, you know, because inmates in America do not have access to the Internet and do not have cell phones, period, you know. So he, you know, the question of is he get special case to, you know, get on the Internet. And then, of course, the floor below, the penthouse floor, would be completely controlled by the Secret Service. They would be his prison guards and keep him safe so nobody could get at him. And, you know, there would be that would be his sentence, his fate. And they could do it, you know, concurrently. You know, okay, he's got 10 years for this, 7 years for this, 12 years for this, 5 years for this. And we could say, okay, well, you got the 12-year one. We'll wrap them all up. We'll give you 12 years. You know, something like that. I can see that happening. I mean, it's absolutely unprecedented, but I can see that happening.
Yeah.
And then, of course, it puts a whole new spin on Ron DeSantis, who I'm talking about with my relatives in Florida. DeSantis is losing support. He's losing money. Apparently, he's boring on the campaign trail. He's mean. He's nasty. He's rude, you know, he's short with people. He doesn't seem to like campaigning. He doesn't, you know, seem to like people, and people don't seem to like him personally.
Well,
I mean, it's not like, you know, Bill Clinton, who I feel your pain and all that. He has none of that quality.
Well, Mother Jones had a front page article on DeSantis this month, and he comes off as you know, I only beg to differ a little bit with you because I think he comes off more. He is now. This is before the article came out like 4 weeks ago, and it's a front cover article. Great illustrations for Mother Jones. I mean, you know, he has fangs. I mean,
he has fangs.
Oh
my God.
Like
a vampire.
He is. The article really goes into depth about how he engages in basically county level Florida purges of, and got his cohorts to go into school boards and county commissioners and ran out even mainly Republicans. He first did the Republicans. He ran out the Republicans that weren't on board with him. This is going back a year or a year and a half. This guy is really diabolical. I think he's and he treats his own help like shit. I mean, he throw bones.
Oh, yeah, exactly. That sort of thing.
Yeah, he treats his supporters who do the dirty work for him. He still treats them like shit. So, I mean, the guy is really, he's very, I think he's dangerous, but I don't know. I think the, like the story with, and how many Republicans read Mother Jones? Hardly any, if any. Yeah,
probably, unless they're doing it for strategic reasons to learn the enemy.
Right, but he's knocking off the moderate Republicans. That's what he's doing in the statewide organization. He's systematically.
He's a nasty SOB, you know. Yeah, really.
Yeah, from the county level, he's like going through. He has already been doing this for like a year and a half, and consequently turning Florida more for DeSantis and the machine he's creating. Mm-hmm. But this article is very clear in Mother Jones. He treats his help because he's betrayed many of the people that helped him do this. And it's like a message to Republicans. It's like, okay, you know, go into a act like you're in a moral panic, knock off the ones that aren't sufficiently against abortion, Republicans, or the ones that are remember log cabin Republicans, the queer Republicans of Barry Goldwater days. You respect those people. No, you can't do that either. You got to run the Republicans that respect queer rights out. You know, I mean, it's sort of interesting to see it to see this, and I think that is why he's losing his support in Florida, even among the Republicans. I think. You know,
right.
What do
well,
you?
I was talking to my brother, the lawyer in Naples. I don't know what his party affiliation. He's a fairly liberal fellow, but he's a you know, a very establishment fellow as well. Lawyer,
well, of course,
probably.
They all act that way.
And so I asked him, well, what's the word on the street, you know, with amongst your Republican pals down there? Are they getting sick and tired of this guy? And has he gone too far? And is he fulfilling my prophecy of being the coyote jump, you know, over the cliff, overextended over the cliff, you know, where it takes him 10 seconds to realize, oh, shit, and then the gravity hits and poof, he's this little poof at the bottom of the canyon.
Right.
You know, as the metaphor for his end. So we'll see, of course. But as I've said, I'd say to my relatives, listen, look at this guy's job resume experience. You know, he cut his teeth on being a JAG lawyer, advising essentially torturers at Guantanamo in how far they can go, what they can do, and things like that. So he's one of these guys that softens torture. But according to some of the people that they force-fed, violently force-fed with Ensure and things like that, that this guy, you know, he was working with the torturers, according to the people who were effectively tortured.
Who were there?
And but he claimed to them, oh no, I'm on your side. You know, they could be, i.e., being they could be worse than they are. Thanks to me, they're so nice. You know, and well, a guy who's won his kind of spurs in that kind of business. I mean, you think of what torture is about. People think, oh, torture is to get at the truth. Well, no, torture is not to get at the truth. Torture is to get an answer that the torturer wants. Whether it's true or whether it's not true, it doesn't matter. You know, the thing that will stop the torture is you tell them things that they want. Jean-Paul Sartre has a famous had a famous short story called The Wall, and about a French resistance fighter who was being tortured by the Nazis in France. And, you know, he's getting the point, you know, he can't, you know, it's terrible what they're doing to him. And so they want to know where a certain, you know, resistance leader is. And so he goes, oh, Christ, I can't take it anymore. I got to stop him. So he tells him, oh, he's under the secondary school. He's in the basement of the secondary school on 3rd and 4th Avenue or whatever. You know, he gives him a name. And, you know, he doesn't think he's there at all.
Uh-huh.
Right? He's just, stop it. Stop it. I'm giving you something you want. Just stop it. Well, you know, the irony, the great sort of staged irony of the story is, the guy's there.
Oh, no.
It's just like coincidence. He's there. And he has to, of course, live with this, you know, that he gave it away. But he, you know, he just wanted him to stop, you know.
Do you think Sartre, now listeners, we're talking about Jean-Paul Sartre, S-A-R-T-R-E, I think is how you spell his last name. But
or Sartre, I think they call it. You know.
Sartre, it's pronounced Sartre. All right, but
yeah, I think. Yeah, I blame him.
Existentialism,
you know.
Do you think he's in that short story telling something? Maybe he might have some personal experience, because I know he was somehow involved in the French resistance against the Nazis.
He was. I remember a professor when I was taking existentialism in college referred to Sartre and his resistance connections. Apparently, this guy seemed to feel, he'd said it with a little sarcasm, that he didn't think Jean-Paul Sartre was running around with a machine gun doing any resistance work in that way. You know, he was a guy who wrote, and he was a you know, sort of a, I guess, a propagandist for the resistance movement. And he was, you know, for the resistance. But he was, you know, an intellectual type. He wasn't a, you know, a gunman or something like that.
Right.
But
right,
still,
right.
He was in the resistance, and he probably knew of people, and he understood torture enough to know that, you know, the irony of the story, of course, is that, you know, he's not telling them the truth. He's telling them what they want to know.
Right.
And that simply stops the torture. And, of course, if they had not found him there, they probably would have come back and put the thumb screws in even worse. But, you know, but that's, of course, the irony is that, you know, he gave the guy away.
Yeah, right.
So you got a guy whose job is to monitor these borderline tortures going on in Guantanamo. You know, I mean, of course, George Bush said, the United States never tortures. Okay, pal.
Right.
You know, so, you know, here he is, the legal, you know, I guess he's read the Geneva Convention, or I don't know what he's prepared for this job as a JAG advisor to these, you know, people shoving tubes of Ensure, you know, in both ends of people, you know, that, you know, they were trying to, you know, starve themselves, and they didn't want the publicity, and they didn't want these guys to be empowered by, you know, fasting themselves and, you know, and dying. So they force-fed them, and, you know, they did it very brutally. And so here's the advisor. He's a legal advisor telling, well, I don't know, you shouldn't do that, or, you know, I'll look the other way, or, you know, whatever, you know. So
what he I think he tried
well, this
to
is the experience of this. How does that apply to governing a state in which your job is to oversee the education of the people in the state and all that? Or is he the guy that wants to enforce people to believe exactly what he wants, which is what the torturer does? You know, look, I don't want any of this goddamn woke shit. I want you to be on my side in abortion and yada, 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 yada. Well, you know, I mean, being a legal advisor for torturers, I don't think is a good resume item for a governor or especially a president of the United States. And I think that should be made clear. But, of course, in the mainstream America, you know, the idea is, oh, I see nothing. We don't talk about that stuff, you know. Anyway, that's my take on Ron DeSantis, is that that all of this stuff may come out, and the fact is, whether it's because he was an advisor for torture or whatever, the fact is he's not a very lovable, friendly guy on the campaign trail, and people don't resonate with him. They don't respond to him that way, you know. It's like, you know, you want the idea that the guy you're going to vote for is at least, you know, cares about you and all this kind of stuff. And if you feel, my God, he doesn't. I mean, I look at the guy and it's like, you know, he doesn't seem to give a rat's ass about me or, you know. Whereas the retail politicians, like, of course, the classic would be Bill Clinton and, oh, I feel your pain, you know, and all this stuff. You know, a lot of that's, of course, bullshit, but it's still a skill, you know, to make people believe that you care about them. You know?
Here's a skill. A real skill. I wish I had that Mother Jones article in front of me so I could responsibly cite the name of the reporter who wrote it. But the funny thing about that article, another big, significant, like 18 column inches of a text of the reporter is dedicated to something real Americans care about, John Grant. And they don't care about torture, brown people in Iraq.
Alas.
They care about being so stupid as to take on Disney in Tampa.
Take on Mickey Mouse, you fool.
You fucking idiot.
You might as well take on the orange industry in central Philadelphia and central Florida. And oh my God, you know.
Oh no, climate change will wipe out the oranges, but we'll still have Disney.
We'll still have fantasy puppets running around. Yeah.
Right. And the Epcot Center. And
right.
Are you ready? Are you ready, yeah. Listeners? Are you ready, listeners?
Give it
75 billion, that's a B, $75 billion in annual tax revenues.
Right, of course.
Yeah, I mean they're
right.
I mean,
and the deal with Disney is, you know, they provide their own police force. Listen, I was in Florida. My brother lived in Orlando at the time. He's going to law school lived in a trailer when they were, you know, there was Disneyland in California, and then they decided they were going to have Disney World in Central Florida. Well, I remember talking to some people who work construction. This was a massive thing, right?
Yeah.
Much bigger than the Disneyland in California. And huge. And then, of course, there's all sorts of accompanying sort of rackets going on around it in the periphery of Disney World. You know, I was with the woman I lived with in Tallahassee. I'm driving down to Florida to see my parents in, 74, I guess it was.
Yeah.
And I'd never been to Disney World as a Floridian.
Oh, I haven't either.
I said to Janet, I said, well, shit, why don't we just, you know, we're driving down to, why don't we stop for a couple hours in Disney World? And we're getting close, and I realize it's like interstate systems which are guiding you to it, you know what I mean? It's like, and I looked and I said, wait a minute. This is a major investment. This is not like going to Petticoat Junction Center in Panama City,
or Dolly Parton in Branson.
Dolly Parton land or all
Branson, Missouri.
Yeah, but there's also when you come down off the that drive in the Smoky Mountain Drive, you come down, you drop into sort of North Carolina there. There's this really, really cheesy country and western sort of town, and there's a Dolly Parton amusement center there.
Right.
You know, Lee Greenwood has a place there, you know, USA, big rah-rah-rah thing.
The Ozark.
Dolly Parton, of course, who's quite liberal person and pretty interesting person. Yeah.
The point is that Disneyland is like just, I mean, the article goes in quite depth about how Disney lawyers, which they unlimited army of lawyers, they held the lawyers back for quite a while before they set them loose like the flying monkeys upon Ron. Governor Ron, but I mean they held off for like 6 months, and the article details every insult that Ron DeSantis put upon the Disney Corporation, and it's caused a grassroots governor movement there around Disneyland.
Well, I read in the paper today he's taking on an anti-corporatist line. That I mean, this is why I say progressives really were fucked over when the Democrats' machine sort of boxed out Bernie Sanders in 2016, because we could have had a populist left and right. Populist left, populist right candidate election. It would have changed history, you know. Mm-hmm. Instead of having a populist right guy against the deep state, you know, candidate. Here is this populist guy. He's trying to be a populist in the right, like Trump, and he's declaring he's anti-corporatist.
Yeah,
which is what the
crazy.
Left's been doing for 50 years, you know, the goddamn corporations. And suddenly the populist right, oh, it's all the problem of the corporations, you know, like, you got to be kidding me. I mean, where do they get the gall of coming out to say they're anti-corporatist? You know, because every fascist movement has a fascist pincer movement, you know, with the corporate elite rich on the top and the uneducated, angry, you know, lynch mob, you know, working class,
right,
beer-drinking schmucks at the bottom, you know, and all their, you know, so that pincer movement between the elite rich and the, you know, the working class angry right, is the key to fascism. Well, how can a potential fascist candidate attack the corporatists? I mean, he can't really be attacking the corporatists because that's where his money comes from. You know, so it's all, it must be a wink, wink, nod, nod kind of thing amongst the elite, the corporate types. You know, Ron's just, you know, he's just saying that, you know. But it's interesting that he's, I mean, it sounded like it was a lot of left-wing kind of things, you know.
They're now
talking, oh, the defense budget. Oh, the problem is the defense budget. I'm going like, you got to be.
Well, who's doing that? The only one I've heard.
They use the defense budget in criticizing the war in Ukraine.
I don't know. I just posted a link.
Mm-hmm.
Senator Bernie Sanders 2 days ago, 48 hours ago, issued mm-hmm. on YouTube and his various outlets,
right,
about he was voting against the military budget of $886 billion. And mm-hmm. it's quite emphatic. I mean, he said Bernie insinuated the same thing about a week and a half ago. Nobody really took him serious, I guess. But now he's voting against the military budget as it stands right now. And but the point for me is that name any of them that have voted to greatly, in any matter, reduce the defense budget. Have you found, any? I mean, Ron DeSantis?
Yeah.
Who? I mean, what Republican? Who? I mean,
Well, the defense budget is Tucker Carlson used to, but he's gone now. But that crossover element between the populist far right and the populist far left is where I'm sort of rummaging around now. Again, this is all sort of in choke, kind of uncertain, vague. It has to
get into the
election to see how these coalitions are going to, if they're going to appear. And, and that sort of thing. But it's going to be some strange bedfellows in this coming election.
I think people are dropping off. I mean, I think the mm-hmm. war in Ukraine, the military budget, mm-hmm. I think, McGregor. He's mm-hmm. a guy who's mortally afraid of the globalists and, he's very popular mm-hmm. on getting if there are any Russian advances in the war, he's the one that can tell you how it's happening and where, and he claims mm-hmm. it. Well, he is himself, if he's scratching, I mean, and they all bloviate, everybody bloviates, but especially Americans. But I mean, he bloviates about the globalists. If he gets beyond his military quote unquote expertise, and I think that he's symbolic of if there is, I wouldn't call him anti-war, but I would call him what? I mean, I think are they reflecting the exhaustion of American people with hearing financing another credit card war with blood on the TV. I mean, you'd think this is Vietnam nowadays mm-hmm. when it comes to coverage. And I find it remarkable. growing up in the America during
the
time.
The Ukraine war.
Yeah,
you're saying.
We're supporting. Yeah. And Ukraine.
Oh, I know. There's at least three stories in every issue of the New York Times. You know, with
and Ukraine is South Vietnam. I'll go that far.
Yeah.
You know, and I just sort of you got to see through all this, and that's not saying that Russia is North Vietnam by any means.
Right, yeah, I can see somewhat of an analogy there. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
The propaganda machines are out there working, and they're much bigger than you and I or Joe Blow down here, you know, at the local bar, you know, having a beer.
But the really hardcore authoritarian candidates like Donald Trump, we know, uses the Ukraine war, you know, because he likes the, you know, countries, nation states, you know, breaking down, of course, in globalism and the internet and all that, the things are sort of coming unglued a little bit. And, you know, the authoritarians like the idea of, you know, to tyrant leaders and, you know, leaders, Vladimir Putin, big swinging dicks that run these countries and no democracy and all that. So, you know, in that case, you know, Donald Trump is ready to hand Ukraine over to Putin. You know, the evidence is there. That's where his inclination is. But then again, you know, it's the war is pretty much entrenched and it's going full guns. So who knows? But, you know, the Ukraine war is certainly going to become a bit of a political football in this coming election.
And
how that sort of materializes, because, you know, you can listen to Ron DeSantis talking about being an anti-corporatist. And, you know, again, it's mind-boggling. You know, this is what Harry Frankfurt talks about. You know, the most salient feature of American culture is there's so much bullshit that a candidate like this can start your favorite word there. I love it. Bloviating about, you know, being an anti-corporatist and, of course, taking on Walt Disney World, you know, like, hello. Walt Disney World, the unique thing about Walt Disney World, it was so damn huge, this construction project, was that Disney came in and got permission from the state of Florida to incorporate Disney World as a municipality. So it had its own police forces, its own jails, and its own courthouses and things like that. It was basically a town, you know, a municipality. And, you know, so they got special features from the state, of course, to bring them in, and, you know, it completely changed Central Florida. It dominated Central Florida. And so it is kind of bizarre that the governor then takes on Walt Disney World, which has been so critical in development of Central Florida that to the point of absurdity, you know. Central Florida is known for the rolling hills of orange groves that look like tufted blankets, you know. And then they're famous for Disney World, and then they're famous for all retired generals and colonels with white belts and white shoes playing golf, you know. I mean, this is what Central Florida is known for. And how could he take on this, you know, my brother laughs about it, the property attorney. He says, you know, the audacity that he takes on Mickey Mouse, you know, it's going to be, I think, is one of the planks in his downfall. You know?
Well,
we'll see. It's going to be entertaining,
ass.
Let me tell you.
He's gone. He's gone, man. I mean, honestly, all those generals and retired military and the gray hairs and the blue hairs. They all want their grandkids.
The golf course,
the golf carts, and then they're on their cell phones in the green, telling their grandkids, yes, you can come to Disneyland and see Mickey Mouse.
Yeah, right.
If you
can look off my
see,
back porch and you can see Mickey's house.
Right. You could come down here and tell your parents to come down here. We'll get you to see Disneyland, of course. I mean, just think of this. I mean, this is like the kid's paradise, and this crazy mofo is fucking running this by. The grandparents, the people that live, that sell the hot dogs at the gate.
Right.
You know, I mean, these people are all going to go, is that fucking governor out of his fucking mind? I mean, Tampa, Florida, where this thing's located. I mean, it's just such an atrocity of economic thinking, you know, that this – talk about.
Well, it's almost like the guy is, you know, I don't want to say he's not very bright because that's always dangerous. You know, we always said Ronald Reagan was stupid or George W. Bush was stupid. These people were not stupid by any stretch of the imagination. But there's something about him that he's almost so full of himself, this idea that, oh, my God, people like it that I'm like kind of a thuggish sort of fellow, and I don't take any shit from people, and I'll, you know, punch you in the face if, you know, people like that, you know, like, oh, so I'm going to play that, I'm going to beat my chest even more, and I'm going to shut down Disney World, I'm going to show my big swinging dick, I'm going to really show them what it's like to be a tough guy, and then all of a sudden people are going like, what? You know, it's almost like Bonhoeffer or that guy in the Nazi Germany. It wasn't Bonhoeffer, the other guy, who said, well, you know, when they came for the Jews, I didn't say anything. When they came for the homosexuals, I didn't say anything. When they, you know, came for the union guys and the union people, I didn't say anything. And then when they came for me, there was nobody left, you know.
Wait a minute.
What are you doing here, you know? And I think Republicans, responsible Republicans, like my brother would know, are finally saying, wait a minute, I'm not sure this is what we bargained for here. And, there seem to be cracks in his campaign right now. So, again, it's all going to be like a roller coaster entertainment that we could look forward to in 2024. And, you know, I'm convinced there will be shootings and, it'll almost be like 68. Going to be a really rock and roll year.
If people,
but then again, I may be hyperventilating
I'm trying to help you, but I'm trying to help the listeners too. I gotta remind everybody, I want to remind everybody that there's always trouble when people get together in large numbers, but that's only in the old days. Nowadays, I firmly believe nowadays that you don't have to have large assemblies. I mean, Black Lives Matter was a very interesting study in sociology. I mean, you didn't see, I mean, there were huge crowds, yes, but honestly, it wasn't like a 250,000 people marching on Name Your Place. I mean, there was.
But there were a lot of them going on in small towns and big towns and cities all over.
It's much more diverse now because of the communication networks that we have now. Far advanced there, Star Trek.
Star Trek level.
Star Trek.
Yeah, we got, you know, the idea of the flash mob, you know, with the iPhone. But, you know, you get 30 people on an iPhone link, and before you know it, you have a riot, you know.
Suddenly it's on local television, you know, if you do it right, you know. I mean, it's very amazing how quickly things like that can happen, and I don't think what they got on their side, the MAGA maggots and the DeSantis vampires, are basically all they got is these crazy individual isolated nuts going into Walmart shooting people with their AK.
I think you got it. I that's the way I see it. Stochastic violence, I sort of, writing my family, I said, well, I gave them my Howard Hughes idea of, you know, how we'll put Donald Trump, ex-president, and prison him in the penthouse and have the Secret Service on the next floor down and all that. And anyway, I'm sorry where I was going.
Well, I mean,
but,
he's got his own cell block. I mean, look at it that way. That's the bright side, Donnie. You'll have your own cell block, and you've got, you know, the Secret Service will feel better because they won't have to wear, you know, suits and ties all day.
They won't have to wear orange jumpsuits, right?
Right, right. You can.
Right. They can be double duty. They can be, corrections. They can be COs, correction officers, and Secret Service bodyguards at the same time.
They wear an ankle bracelet, and you can go to the golf course, the executive prison golf course that we have over here, and you'll be all right. No. Oh, by the way, Ivanka has flown back to Slovenia. So, I mean
really?
It's sort of like, she's good. Yeah, his wife is going to leave to Slovenia. That's the next best.
You mean his current, not Ivanka, you mean his...
What's her name? Mel? What's her name? I've already forgot her name.
I'm having a brain fart myself.
Melania.
Yeah, Melania
is going to fly back to Slovenia.
Right.
And have her and further build the parent's nest.
Well, apparently she's spending a lot of time concentrating on her son. What is it, Brian or whatever his name is?
Baron,
who's probably 18, 19 now, and
he's quite a guy.
She's very much concerned about her child with him, as she should be. And the interesting question in my Howard Hughes scenario for his imprisonment would be,
right.
Conjugal visits. Would, inmates are in some places have conjugal visits, but, your wife or girlfriend can't live with you, but, she can visit you once every 2 weeks,
But then Melania
might not want to do that.
She doesn't want that anymore. Just look at her. She doesn't want it anymore. She doesn't want mushroom dick.
I don't know what she wants.
She doesn't want mushroom dick, believe me.
Well, I wasn't going to get that funky, but that's okay.
Well, this is Radio Free Kansas. I mean,
This is Radio Free. Right. Of course, right.
I mean, after how
we have very high standards on Radio Free Kansas.
We have. It's white trash radio, wall to wall. Well, what I'm trying to say is that I don't think Ron DeSantis cuts the mustard, and I don't think.
No, I don't. I think you're right.
And I think mustard hair, Donnie Trump is probably going to have a problem himself. I think they're in a real. I just hope Sleepy Joe doesn't hit any more sandbags. That's all I give a shit about.
Trump is pretty shaky. Remember, he was almost fell over walking down that little incline. Trump is like virtually as old. I mean, he's what 70? He's my age, 76, I guess, 77.
You're better than that. I mean, you. But hey, what about Mitch McConnell, Senator Mitch McConnell?
He's gone.
20 seconds.
Finished.
I mean, I got my stopwatch out in time, but I got 35 seconds. On him freezing. I think he froze up deep. He went deep.
Well, the guy has traumatic brain injury, TBI, which was made fashionable over the Iraq War. He hit his head pretty hard, concussion.
Oh, that's right. But
oh
not
yeah,
in the war.
That was the.
He fell over.
TBI has nothing to do with war. It has to do with cracking your head. And, you can have TBI from a concussion or you can have it from an explosion that rattles your brain around, I guess. But, he just had a vacuum in his mind. Suddenly it was like, duh, you didn't have nothing to say for 20 seconds or something. And they were going, oh, Mitch, here, let me finish your thought here. And,
I got 35.
So I think 30. Mitch. I think Mitch, the same way as that California woman, what's her name, Senator is
Diane.
Yesterday,
Diane.
2 days, Diane Feinstein. Sure. She was supposed to give a yay or nay vote, right? And she had her aides were behind her, and she started giving a long speech, and her aides saying, "No, Diane, just a yay or a nay, and say yay. You're on a yay on this," and you could hear him. And she's, oh, really? Okay, yay. And, she was ready to just go on, give this speech. And
good,
no,
that's good.
That's not right. You're not supposed to be giving a speech.
Just a vote. Right. Just a vote.
Turn it off. Shut up. Yeah, so it's about time for her to retire, you know? I mean, God bless her.
I don't care if she does. She represents a district of people who are a lot like her. But, I mean, Mitch McConnell, that's Kentucky. I mean, my God, I know there's some hillbillies in Kentucky that make great white lightning. And I'm just like, why do they want or want to be represented by a guy who, you know, who I for years have heard people say he's a turtle. He's a turtle face.
Right.
Mitch McConnell.
Turtleneck.
And there for a while there, when I was running my stop clock and I got up to 35 seconds and finally somebody escorted him off the microphone, I said, it was like watching a turtle. I said, have you ever watched a turtle, John? I mean, they don't move very fast. I mean,
I've seen turtles, you know. Yeah,
he was a turtle that day. He was certainly a turtle. It was amazing. I thought, wonder how many tens of millions of people are going to see the man as he is.
Yeah, being a run-of-the-mill senator is one thing, but being majority leader is another thing.
Yeah.
And to have the majority leader who, you know, has TBI and has moments where he just sort of, his intellectual capacity just collapses and he goes he stares at you with a 1,000-yard stare. You know, this is not a type of leadership anybody wants, you know, so you know, he's going to be, I don't know, he was just reelected, I think, wasn't he?
Oh, God, I probably, who knows?
Yeah, probably, yeah. He seems to be on the way out, you know. I mean, he certainly, you know, Republicans and conservatives love him because he basically screwed the Democrats and, you know, made Obama's 8 years an absolute nightmare in that respect. And he helped facilitate Donald Trump getting three Supreme Court justices, which is completely unprecedented, unheard of. And he helped facilitate that piece of dumb that he is.
We're going to live with that for a long, long time.
You got it.
What you did hear, did you catch when he recovered, when he came back to the real world? He no longer left the UFOs hearing, you know. I mean, he was, you know, he was no longer there being beamed around. He was, a reporter caught him while he was leaving, and he was back cognizant and lucid or whatever. And he was chuckling, and they stuck a mic, and he says, the president called me and told me to watch out for the sandbags.
Is that what he said?
That's what he said. So Mitch came back pretty quick. I mean, he said the president
called
me.
That was a good comeback. That was a damn good comeback.
He's going to have his moments. I mean,
those sandbags jump out at you, you know.
One thing
about my aging, and I was telling my wife this the other day, and I've done this, I move very carefully and slowly because I don't want to lose my balance and fall over. And if I do, I've sort of practiced and thought about it that I will roll and land on my right shoulder or my shoulder, left shoulder. And roll, you know. So
and roll.
And actually, Biden did a roll pretty good when he tripped on that sandbag. You know, he recovered well. He wasn't injured. And I remember he was trying to climb up to Air Force One and something. And he kept tripping. He tripped about three times going up. And, he got out of that alive without a broken leg or anything. And,
the general staff had their trophy wives there in the front row. If you ever see that video, listeners, watch very carefully the dishwater blondes with the sunglasses, the big sunglasses, right there on the front row, and you can just see their faces like, oh, my God, he's falling in slow motion.
He's stumbling up the stairs.
you remember
the classic was Gerald Ford, you know, he stumbled coming down Air Force One, you know. He was a fairly young man, relatively speaking, and rather athletic.
What was the joke about Jerry? It was something about too many footballs came in the head. What was that about?
He got tackled one too many times. I don't
Okay, I forgot. I couldn't read
that. Yeah, but he was sort of he's, I guess the one claim to fame was he pardoned Richard Nixon. You know, that's what his job
well,
was.
Well, oh no,
he pulled that off.
Yeah, he helped the Warren Commission. He was on the Warren Commission with Kennedy's assassination.
There,
God, there's no end to that. Maybe we'll have to play some riffs tomorrow or next Tuesday, listeners, with John Grant about Robert F. Kennedy Jr.
Oh, God, he's talk about entertaining. My God, he's really entertaining. Have you seen how buff he is? I mean, he's like Arnold Schwarzenegger on a... You know, a little, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger in decline, but still he's all beefed up, and he's got this, almost sounds like Tom Waits when he talks. Like,
well, now that, you know, the official line from them is that he had a disease when he was a kid or something that affected him. I always thought he just smoked too much crack. But I mean, you know,
well, I don't know what it is. I don't know, but he's definitely out there. Let me say that. You know, it's like, ooh.
Well, he's got the position. I don't know. We'll have to take it apart. Maybe we can get him on air. We can ask him.
Well,
John
hey,
Grant.
There you go.
Yeah,
okay.
Let's call him up. John Grant.
Okay.
Thank you, John.
Hey, Mike Cadell. Radio
right,
Free Kansas. All right.
That's right.
Take care.
White trash radio. Brought to you by your Cracker Network. We're working on it here, folks, in North Jefferson County, Kansas. Take it up, Kristen. Let's get out of here.